I'm going to start by telling you a joke that may or may not find its way to tie in with the rest of the sermon, but we're going to hope so. You should know, you need a little background on this. The Jewish High Holy Days are primarily two days, which are Rosh Hashanah, which is the New Year, and Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And they come a few days apart. So every time it's the High Holy Days, all the Jewish people, like Christians, go to Christmas and Easter. Jewish people go to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services. So this starts out with this man who lives by himself, and he's walking through the marketplace one day, and he hears what sounds to be like a parrot speaking Yiddish. And he goes over to the stall, and he discovers that indeed there is a Yiddish-speaking parrot. And he's sort of lonely, and turns out that this parrot has learned Yiddish from a family that he belonged to, and they've recently died. And so he buys this parrot and he takes it home, and he's so pleased because now he has a little company, and they chatter together and they're very happy. And then it comes to be the Sabbath, and the man is in the habit of doing his prayers, his Hebrew prayers at home, and he starts doing his Hebrew prayers, and the parrot in Yiddish says to him, "Can I learn those prayers too?" And the man answers back, "You're a parrot. You can't do prayers." He said, "Try me. I can learn Hebrew. You'll see." So the man says, "Who cares? All right, it's just the two of us." So he teaches him the prayers, and for several weeks, he's very impressed because the parrot is really very precocious and quite devoted, and together they do their prayers, and it's nice company for the man. So then it comes time for the High Holy Days, and so the man's going to go to the Rosh Hashanah service, which comes first, and the parrot says, "Don't leave me at home. Take me with you." He said, "You're a parrot. You can't come." He says, "I can do the prayers. You know I can do the prayers." So he puts the parrot on his shoulder and he goes to the temple. And he gets to the temple and the people say, "This is a parrot. You can't bring him in." He says, "He knows the prayers. You'll see." And the man says, "You're crazy. You can't bring him in." So they have a discussion, and finally the owner of the parrot gets a little irate. And he says, "I bet you $100 that this parrot can do the prayers as well as anyone." So a lot of people take him up on it, and he just writes out all these IOUs, and he's just really certain. So they go into the service. Comes time for the prayers. Parrot is absolutely silent. Not a word. Not Hebrew, not Yiddish, nothing. He just sits there. The man's, you know, moving his shoulder and trying to show him the book and all this. Parrot does nothing. The whole service, the parrot does nothing. And all his friends are really proud, and they go out. Turns out now the man owes his friends $3,000, which he doesn't have, and he's just completely like this. And as soon as they're away from everyone, the parrot starts whistling and chattering, and the man says, "What is wrong with you? I have to pay $3,000 I don't have now. Why didn't you speak then?" And the parrot says, "Ah, just think of the odds we're going to get on Yom Kippur." I've had that joke for so long, I couldn't resist. Now, I'll try to tie it into what we're doing. You know, we all have a very linear idea of what the spiritual path should look like. And what we actually have is a very outward idea of what the spiritual path should look like. We have all these ideas of all these different behaviors, the things that we should do. This is what a spiritual person looks like. Just recently, and even still, we have this week of Spiritual Renewal Week at Ananda Village, and our temple closes for a week, and many people go up there, and many are still up there. A lot of familiar faces aren't here today because the week ends this morning. On Wednesday night, they have a play. It's a play that Swami Kriyananda wrote. It's called The Peace Treaty. It's a huge production, 30 members in the cast. It's a three-act play. And for several years, I've helped with the costumes, and everything in life takes longer. That's one of my mantras. Everything takes longer. No matter how many times I do costumes, no matter how many times I cook a meal, whatever it might be, it always takes longer. I try to remember that, but I always forget. So there it is. So we're working with these costumes, and there's hardly anything to do this year. They're all fixed up. Still, it's just taking so much time. You know, we are not dawdling. We are moving in a very focused, intent manner. And this woman who was there with us, helping us, who was a professional makeup artist who made everybody look really gorgeous this year, said something at some point about how she always thought everyone at Ananda would be so peaceful, you know, just peaceful. And here we are just working like like crazy people trying to get this thing done. I said, well, we might not be agitated, but it's not always possible to be peaceful. So we have to get all this done, and we have a very short period of time, and then the play starts, and we have to do it. And it's just sort of like when we begin on this path, we project out somewhere what we think it's going to be like. And a great deal of what we think is really just made up. It's made up from bad movies or just sheer imagination. And when we get onto the spiritual path ourselves and begin to get serious, we always have this discrepancy between what we think it was supposed to be like and what actually happens when we as individuals begin to unravel our own karma. Because whatever our karma is, we can't always anticipate what it is. We just are at a certain point and we begin to wake up, and the nature of that awakening is to begin to understand that this world is not exactly what it seems, and that all of this external preoccupation is not really going to be the place where what we're looking for inside is going to be found. The unifying quality of people who are interested in Ananda, interested in self-realization, is a very simple one. It's beginning to understand that the key element for my success and happiness in life is my own inner consciousness. And that, yes, the external circumstances will influence me, and I may have strong feelings and desires and karmic inclinations that have to be carried out, but the origin of what is happening in my life is internal. And therefore, must apply at least some, if not all, of my creative, intelligent willpower energy toward adjusting internally in order to have even the external life that I want. You can be from any race, culture, economic, ethnic group, age, anything. But that is the unifying factor. Because unless and until we're willing to do battle with our own inner realities, this is the symbol of Arjuna in the story of the Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita itself. He's the warrior, and he must fight. But what he's fighting for is his own right consciousness. But when that awakening begins to occur to us, we have already had all of this life, whatever age we are, and many, many incarnations before that have molded us in such an exact way. It's so extraordinary just to look at faces in a crowd. So many ages, so many cultures, so many experiences, so many points of view, and every bit of that is just etched into the faces we carry around. And when we decide we want to bring all of that experience into harmony with a greater reality than just our ego preferences, it's a fascinating and amazing process. And we really have no idea when we begin where that road is going to take us, who we are and what we're going to have to do. So to try to apply to that some very narrow little idea of what spirituality is or what it looks like. You know, often those who purport to have very little belief are in the end much more deeply spiritual because of their true understandings of life. To have a dogmatic external commitment to this particular religion is not necessarily the sign of being a very spiritual person. Being a very spiritual person is a state of consciousness. It's our inner awareness. It's where we are on that spectrum, as we were talking about in the reading a little bit today, between tamasic energy, which is just downward pulling and doesn't even want to transform itself, and rajasic energy, which is full of life and activity, but not necessarily in an upward-directed manner, but just moving around in circles, either enjoying or suffering, but just constantly moving around, you know, just restlessly doing things. And sattvic energy, which is when we begin to come in harmony with our higher selves. Now, we have to understand that this is progressive, and this is where the joke comes into play. When Swamiji is talking in the extended commentary on this, he remarks that tamasic people simply need to have energy moving. And self-centered desire for self-aggrandizement and power and money and pleasure and all the things that appear to be the answer to our longings, tamasic people often think, oh, I'm too lazy even to go after my desires. I think I'll renounce them. And you sometimes find in spiritual works people who are not really genuinely good, but they're just sort of hoping for a free ride. You know, just I'll hang out with these people, I'll join this church, I'll assert these beliefs, and then my position will be in heaven, will be safe. But in fact, oftentimes, people who don't even put out enough energy to fulfill their desires need to start first by fulfilling their desires. That's why I'm saying what is actually spiritual is not such a textbook example. Sometimes a person's alternative to self-centered action is no action at all. In other words, pure laziness. As Swami Kriyananda asserts, has put forward several times, if somebody who's just done nothing but lie on the couch and watch television suddenly becomes so inspired by all those commercials to decide that he's going to go out and get a job and earn money and buy things, well, that now for him, that would be a tremendous step forward because he would beginning to exercise his creative will, to use his energy to accomplish his desires. And it's not as if those desires in themselves are going to give him what he wants or are so laudable, but the action of doing so and the experience of learning his own power by following those desires is giving him the raw material that he needs. And as his desires elevate, he'll have the tools to fulfill them. And so it's true for us as devotees. Even if our desire now is not so much for material things or for physical pleasure, but for more subtle states of consciousness, but energy, concentration, determination, creativity, perseverance, these are the qualities that are needed. The very same qualities that a successful businessman has to have, or a talented artist, or a good musician. You have to persevere against obstacles. You have to learn the method. You have to overcome your own fears. You have to overcome your resistance to hard work. All of those qualities are what make a spiritual person. Sri Ramakrishna, who was a great master in the 1800s in Bengal, in India. At that time, the theater people were not considered to be very high caste. And he lived in a time, he was a high caste person himself, and many of those who were around him were very high caste people. And one of his very famous and deeply devoted disciples was a famous Bengali playwright. Girish Ghosh was his name. And he was a very passionate and emotional, feeling man. And he wrote many wonderful plays in Bengali. And he was part of this whole theater world. He became very devoted to Ramakrishna. And he brought all these artistic people to Ramakrishna, who the Brahmins considered to be low caste. But Ramakrishna just mixed with them freely and was very affectionate and very taken by their energy. And they were very talented people, the cream of that group. And after they left, some of the other Brahmins were tutting about these low-caste people. And Ramakrishna's answer was a very profound and important one. He said, yes, he said, it's true, at this time, the god they worship is music and art. He said, but oh, they know how to worship. Now that's what we have to understand. We really have to know how to worship. We have to take whatever we're going to do, and we have to do it with the absolute best energy that we can bring to it. For one, it's training to be a devotee. And for the second is, we don't get out of our desires by just hiding away from them. I've told some of you the story, you may remember, but since so many of the regular faces are not here, many of you don't know these stories, so I can just tell it again. Isn't that great? When David and I were first married, which was now almost 30 years ago, we were living at Ananda Village, and Swami Kriyananda suggested that we build a house right near where Crystal Hermitage is, where his house is. And I, of course, was delighted to move close to where he was living. For those of you who know, that house is now the guest house for Crystal Hermitage. But I had always had this association in my mind with my security on the spiritual path was that I was poor. I didn't have any money. And my security was that I didn't want money. And my security was not having money, I wouldn't be tempted by anything. And also, there's that Kali Yuga idea, this idea left over from the age we're just coming out of, where the material world is really evil, and poverty is a sure sign of spirituality. St. Francis of Assisi had to assert that very strongly. He had to strongly repudiate the wealth into which he was born, because in that age, you simply couldn't bring both realities together. But now our age has advanced, and our world is more subtle, and we understand that everything is just a manifestation of energy. In Kali Yuga, things were fixed. That was the age of matter. And so there was either wealth or there was poverty. There was either money or there was spirituality. There was either family life or there was the monastery. They didn't understand it as an age. All saints understand the same thing. But when Francis was born there, he had to teach to the society in which he was living. A master is free in his own consciousness, but he's bound by the people and the culture into which he incarnates. So in the age that Francis lived, people were very fixed in their ideas. They didn't understand that it's the energy and the consciousness with which you do things. It's not the things in themselves. Nowadays, I can say that to you all. I can say that in almost any circle of people, not even spiritual people necessarily, almost any circle of people, you can talk about matter being energy. Einstein put that out there. The physicists today are just taking down all the barriers. So we understand that it isn't so much what you do or what you have, but it's the consciousness behind it. That's what constitutes whether or not your attitude is spiritual and whether your actions are taking you toward God or not. But all of us, especially of my generation, who have grown up in this transition time, with a sort of a little bit of confusion in our minds. And when we started building that house, to come back to that, my thought was, okay, we're going to have this house, but my way of making it spiritual was to do it badly. You know, which is, I'll put out bad energy. I won't concentrate on this. I won't try to make it attractive. I'll just do it badly. And then in that way, I'll make sure that it doesn't lead me into delusion. One of the great lessons I learned from David very quickly after we got married was that whereas my mind was all divided up at that time into spiritual, non-spiritual, acceptable, non-acceptable, he just understood life as a flow. If he had to deal with money, he dealt with money. If he had to deal with meditation, it was meditation. He was already in that Dwapara understanding that it's all just energy. And he wanted to make a nice house. For heaven's sakes, a house stands for a long time. You know, even if it's small, which it's not a large house, make it nice. Why not? And after a certain period of time, his comment to me was, if you're not going to be helpful, at least get out of the way. You know, and that was when I began to sort of be all sort out in my head. And I began to look more carefully at Swami Kriyananda, who the founder of Ananda, the direct disciple of Yogananda, has always been our example. And I realized something that had always confused me. Whenever he did anything, no matter what it was, he did it well. And he did it beautifully. And he didn't always do it cheap. You know, I always thought, well, at least do it cheap. You know, just sort of all these different ideas in your mind. He did it as it needed to be done. He moved through life and even moves through life now according to what doing things as they need to be done. Not extravagantly, but not in such a frugal way that what you're trying to accomplish is hindered by our lack of courage to commit energy to it. You know, because it's learning how to let that energy flow, to move through these different elements of first just being too lazy even to put out energy. And in the expanded commentary of this, which I was starting to say a while ago, Swamiji comments that for tamasic people, selfish desires are God's way of reaching them. You know? But for someone who's already dynamic in their energy, has already begun to realize that I am a part of all that is, and the more that I unite my energy with others and consider their welfare my own, that's a much higher reality to live in. And then higher still is to recognize that it's really God's energy that I'm relating to. It's divine energy in all. First, we love ourselves and what we can get for ourselves. then we love a few people who have some egoic relationship to us, my children, my husband, my home, and we'll spend for those things. We'll commit our energy to help the things that we define as our own. But then we move to a higher level still, which is what we experience when we begin to meditate and when we begin to live according to the principles of self-realization. We begin to understand, where is the boundary of myself? That even this little body that I just live in for a time, that I am responsible for taking care of, it's not God's will that I throw this life away frivolously, but even still, this is just a temporary home. This is just who I am for now, and there's this enduring reality that unites me to everything in this universe. This is when we begin to talk about, and we talk about it in our Sangha often. You know, the Sangha has to be supported by the people who participate in it. I mean, we've had discussions about whether or not it's appropriate to talk about money from the pulpit. I'm going to talk about it for a minute, you know, because there's no reason to be delicate about any aspect of life, and money is a fundamental aspect of life, and watching how we spend our money. If you want to know who you are, watch how you spend your money. You know, write down where you spend it. See what you spend it on. See who you spend it on. See what causes you're willing to spend your money on, freely or reluctantly. This tells us who we are. And every spiritual work in the world, it has to be supported by someone. And it needs to be supported above all by those people who believe in it, for whom it is not something that they are doing, but something that I am doing. And that necessity, which is a characteristic of our world, to donate to the causes you believe in, because the cause in itself is not a business, the cause in itself is a service, and the response of those who benefit from it is that they should want to give to it. And not that you should give to it, but that you should want to give to it. You see? Because who are we? What is important to us? For what are we responsible? We feed ourselves and we never hesitate to do that. We always feed ourselves. We buy ourselves a winter coat when it's cold. We rent a house for ourselves because we define that as our responsibility. Well, what makes it yours? What makes it yours? You have to ask yourself that question. What in this world is really mine? And all of the altruistic causes in the world try to persuade us to consider the needs of whatever group it is, whether it's starving children in one country or, you know, sick adults in this country or homeless people or hungry people. We say, is this my responsibility? And you see, souls go out and dedicate their lives to extraordinary causes. You know, a whole life lived in some very difficult place because these are my people in one reason or another. And all through our lives, what we're being asked to do is to expand our sense of self to a bigger and bigger reality. And when we make that identification, to do it with our whole heart, with our whole mind, with our whole spirit. Because the only way we escape from these things is to do them well. Because what causes us not to do them well is this downward pulling energy. And it's not really the excellence of the result that is the spiritual thing. It's the excellence of the effort required to bring about that result. Because that trains us. We have to learn how to worship. And God uses in a very remarkable way our own desires. Our desires to have a family, and then you have to feed them and educate them. You know, a desire to have a mate, and then that spouse brings into your life all these other things that you might not have had the motivation to do on your own. Or God gives you a certain talent, and you're restless until you have the opportunity to fulfill that talent. Or a compassion for others. That just requires that we develop our ability to express who we are. And God plants those desires in us. It's not like it's more spiritual to want to do nothing. You see, that's the misunderstandings we get. Oh, we're not supposed to have any desires. Okay, I think I'll just sit here. But then you look at the true masters, the true saints, and they put out so much energy. Swami Kriyananda, just the standard he sets of what it means to be a disciple of this path, well, just is going to keep us busy for a really long time. You know, just so many different artistic, creative projects, just one after another, and at the age of 85, just still going, you know, as strong as his body will allow him, just putting out energy for one reason and one reason only. I have found his life. He has found such joy in this path of self-realization and the teachings of Paramhansa Yogananda. He cannot contain it. He has to give it away. It's the nature of joy to want to share itself. And ultimately, that's what we discover. We start getting things for ourselves, and then we start wanting others to have them. And the more joyful we become in what we're doing, the more dynamically we embrace, for our own satisfaction, the pleasure of giving those to others. And then the effort to do that teaches us how to worship. Worship is to have something at the center of your reality and to give your whole heart, mind, and soul to it. That's what Ramakrishna talking about those artists. They knew how to worship. There's an apocryphal or famous remark of someone saying to one of the great violinists of all times, "Oh, I'd give my life to be able to play the way you do." And he said, "I have." You know, nothing comes to us without real dedication. And God comes to us through real dedication. A friend of mine who was a physicist getting his PhD at Stanford, he was concerned, he said, because he said, "I sit down to do physics problems in the morning and I look up and the day is gone." I said, "Don't be concerned. Thank God every day. You know that something is taking your heart, mind, and soul so deeply. Give yourself to whatever it is that God has put in front of you to do. Learn how to worship. Learn how to worship first by what comes naturally to you, and then in the fulfillment of that experience and the training of your consciousness, you will find that God himself will take you step by step by step, finally into the home of the truest fulfillment of all, which is to worship the divine within. God bless you.